Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoy the program.
And on ABC Radio around Australia and on your pod, you're with me, Noel Devine, and my guest in this hour is the religion correspondent from The Times in London, Ruth Gledhill. Ruth, welcome back to the program.
Good evening.
Ruth, I've been reading your stuff over the last few days, and it seems the Archbishop of Canterbury in Zimbabwe has gotten a fair bit of coverage, but also traction.
He has achieved really quite remarkable results. There was quite a lot of cynicism about the possible outcomes of his visit to Central Africa, which included Zimbabwe as well as Zambia and Malawi. And there were fears specifically that his attempt to meet with Robert Mugabe would result in a propaganda coup for the president and for his regime and all its human rights abuses, and that Rowan would go away defeated and that the situation might be even worse for the Anglicans there, who've suffered every abuse up to murder, actually, in their battle with the renegade Anglicans who've broken away, led by a Mugabe crony, Kunonga. But to everyone's surprise, Rowan actually managed to get a meeting with Mugabe. He took in some of the African bishops with him. He presented him with a dossier of abuse. So when Mugabe's excuse had always been, well, I don't know what's going on. I don't know the detail. I know nothing about these abuses. Well, presented with this dossier.
This is the letter signed by the Primate of Central Africa, Albert Chama, I think, and six other bishops.
Exactly. There was that letter, but accompanying it was a whole list of the atrocities committed against Anglicans in the name of justice and law by Kunonga, who seems to have managed to get the courts on his side up until now, because after that meeting, almost, Rowan Williams was actually only still in the air on his way back when two key court judgments went against Kunonga, and two of his bishops have even been threatened with jail if they don't hand a particular property back to the legitimate Anglicans. So Rowan seems to somehow, over tea and scones, you know, this surreal meeting that they had with this kind of overtones of a British tea party in Zimbabwe with Mugabe, he seems to have managed to get the message across and to have managed to bring about some immediate change for the better. So we'll just have to see where it goes. But certainly, even if it continues to get worse, as I suppose everyone fears it might, and even might even expect it might, Rowan Williams has come out of it a really totally vindicated in his decision to go there and to try and do what no official government spokesman from Britain has done for more than a decade. There's been no official representational visit from Britain for more than a decade. So although he's a church visitor, the fact that the Church of England is established in England means that, you know, he does have an unofficial but nevertheless visible representational role.
Well, he's in the House of Lords, of course. And it strikes me, though, as quite, interesting that somebody who officially has no canonical jurisdiction in the way, say, the Pope does over the Catholic Church in Zimbabwe, but whose position is in one sense honorary, it's one of honour rather than legal power, has gotten a tremendous amount of traction and in fact has been very effective.
Exactly. And as spiritual leader, as primus inter pares of the Anglican Communion and spiritual leader of the family of worldwide Anglican churches in the Anglican Communion, about 38 provinces, he always says he has moral authority but no actual juridical authority. And this is a very rare example of how he has used that moral authority to effect juridical change almost. I mean, that's how it's looking at the moment anyway.
There's life left in the Archbishop of Canterbury's office yet.
Well, you know, a few weeks ago we were all writing stories saying he might resign. He might go early.
Indeed.
And I wouldn't be surprised if now he stays on a bit longer.
Now, the other thing that I think you've touched upon is the situation of the Coptic Christians in Egypt.
Yes, they're having a terrible time. They're suffering the most frightful persecution. They're a minority faith, they're a minority denomination, a fractional really compared to the Muslim majority. And even the Catholic Church in Egypt, which is even smaller, has spoken out officially for the first time ever really, but spoken out officially on their behalf, trying to stop the persecution of Christians. And the situation in Egypt seems to be deteriorating very badly for the Christians. there seems to be very little acknowledgement or recognition of their historic place in that country's religious tradition.
This is the church which was established, according to the Copts, by St. Mark himself, the gospel writer.
Exactly. The junta there has been accused of using rabble force against the Christians. And as is so often the case, as has been the case in Zimbabwe and other parts of Africa and now in the Middle East, what seems to happen is there are attacks on the Christians who then defend themselves and then are portrayed in the resulting publicity as coordinated by the regime, whichever regime it is, as the aggressors. Their defense, their self-defense, is portrayed as being the initial aggression, which then is used to justify further crackdowns on them. So the Arab Spring that everyone's been hailing looks like it's going to have a few more than nasty showers for the poor minority faith, the Christians, the other minority faiths such as the Baha'is elsewhere in the Middle East.
Occupy Wall Street is the other running story around the world, and it does have a religious dimension. Now, you've had events there in London, as we've had here in Sydney, Brisbane, Melbourne, Adelaide, Perth. What form has it taken there?
Well, it's been relatively peaceful in London. They tried to protest in a space near the Stock Exchange where they weren't allowed, so they moved a little way away to St. Paul's Cathedral. And there's a lovely picture of a man there dressed up as Jesus with carrying a poster, a placard, "I threw out the moneylenders for a reason," which, of course, it's been pointed out to me on my Twitter feed because I tweeted that picture, that, of course, he's theologically incorrect because Jesus actually threw out the money changers, not the moneylenders. And Jesus' concerns were cultic as well as economic. So it's easy to, and many of the protesters are doing this for understandable reasons, it's easy to classify their protest as good versus evil, you know, the poor people versus the rich people, the rich man at his table, the poor man at his gate, and so forth. But it's more complicated than that, as these things always are. And I think in America especially, and a little bit in Australia, but in America especially, lots of people with other agendas have been jumping on the Occupy Wall Street bandwagon. You know, just as we saw in London a few weeks ago, when there's a riot happening, people, disruptive people, just join in. Really, I think the campaign is against corporate greed. That's the root of it.
That seems to be the unifying theme that's emerging, corporate greed.
Exactly. And who doesn't have some sympathy with that? Greed is one of the seven deadlies. We don't hear enough talked about it. It's not condemned enough as a human failing in our public discourse. And yet it's greed that's taken us to the brink where this financial crisis that is engulfing the world at the moment. One of the Times columnist, Caitlin Moran, who's got nearly 200,000 followers on Twitter, she wrote a very moving, powerful column in the Times yesterday. Caitlin comes from a very, very poor background, and she's just published a best-selling book on how to be a woman. And this is taking her into the league of, you know, the very wealthy, if not the super rich. And she wrote this column about what it was like to be very, very poor and what it's like now to be rich, and having come from a very, very poor background. And she wrote about how when you're poor, your limbs are weighted down by rain. It just seems never to stop raining, and this weights your limbs down, and you can't do anything. Now, in Britain, one of the ways that we're responding to the financial crisis is by cracking down on benefit fraud and that kind of thing. And she makes the point that if you're going to get poor people into a kind of material improvement in material wealth, you have to enable them, you have to give them agency, you have to show them how to become rich. But by just simply taking away what little they've got, i.e. their benefits, which has happened particularly in Britain in education actually, by taking away that, you're just making their limbs even heavier. You know, it just kind of increases the flow of the rain, and you actually make them even more powerless. And there is a growing anger, even in Britain, and we saw that in our riots, I think. That was what our riots were really all about. That's the way the poor people are the ones who are being hammered, while the rich people are sort of seem to be getting away with it. They just seem to be getting richer. And this is something that the Archbishop of Canterbury is constantly going on about. He has been ever since he became Archbishop. And he's very Cassandra-like. It's almost as if no one's ever believed him, and he keeps on saying it, and he keeps on saying it, and he's actually being proved right. And I think the Occupy Wall Street, for whatever the nature of people's personal disgruntlement that they're using this as an excuse to kind of wreak a little bit of havoc. Nevertheless, there is legitimate concerns behind these protests about the very real greed that we see paraded in front of us on a daily basis by these bankers, who many of them haven't come, like Caitlin, from very poor backgrounds, and have no idea, as Caitlin said, no idea at all what it actually is like to be poor when you're sleeping on mattresses on the floor, when pudding at your main Sunday lunch is a Mars bar divided between 12 people.
Mm.
They've got no idea, and I think the Occupy Wall Street protesters are trying to give them some idea. There's an important lesson about greed there, an important moral and theological lesson, and I wish our church here in Britain was saying and doing a bit more about it and was kind of having the courage to get into its pulpit and just hammer the message home about greed, about sheer greed.
Well, that's a story that has a while to run yet, I think. There's still events connected to Occupy Wall Street going on around the world, and that's one to keep an eye on, I think, and we'll see what the outcomes are as time goes by. On the Australian side of things, Wednesday of this week, I think only 3 days away, Pope Benedict XVI will be opening Domus Australia, the Domus Australia, which is the pilgrim centre in Rome, which a number of dioceses here in Sydney, Melbourne, Perth, Canberra, Goulburn, Lismore have put together money to buy a property in Rome, and it's going to become basically a pilgrim hotel where Australians can gather. Now, while that's happening, we've got another story here about rationalisation of resources going on here in Australia, where it appears a feasibility study is going ahead on the viability of our theological colleges in light of a review that's coming up.
Yeah, this comes out of a review that the Prime Minister announced that universities will be funded on the basis of student demand. So only large universities will be funded for research, and this will create a second-class group of teaching universities. As has been pointed out, this is going to have a significant effect on tertiary education in Australia, and particularly on Catholic tertiary education. Now, there was a very interesting memo leaked from the president of the Catholic Institute in Sydney. In this memo, he says that the Chancellor of the Institute, Cardinal Powell, spoke at a recent meeting of the Senate about the future of the Institute. And he's looking at ways, exploring ways to make, you know, this phrase always comes up in these memos, doesn't it? Significant annual savings to the budget. Now, of course, he promises that if this were to result in an alliance with the University of Notre Dame, that the Institute would maintain its autonomy, even though it would be relocated. But this will raise fears that it won't be able to retain its autonomy in the way that it does now. What happens to the awards? What happens to the students presently in education? And just what happens to the Institute itself? It's quite serious because the Institute is so highly regarded.
The rationalising of universities that's going to happen will, of course, look at size. And when you've got faculties in Sydney, for example, two Catholic universities competing for students in the one city, which are not major universities yet. They're relatively new in Sydney and don't have the size, clout or influence of our sandstone universities, as we call it. And the thing with the Catholic Institute of Sydney is that it contains or owns a library called the Veitch Library, which would be the largest Catholic collection of theology in the Southern Hemisphere in an English-speaking institution. And there would be concerns, I think, over where that will be and how it will be housed.
Well, that's the most important thing, isn't it, alongside the education of the students, the future of that library. I guess that library might be moved into the Notre Dame University, is that correct?
I think the study will look at all sorts of possibilities, but should the Catholic Institute, which is a pontifical faculty giving Roman degrees, end up part of Notre Dame, there will have to be all sorts of matters like that worked through and decided.
If that does happen, if it becomes part of Notre Dame, wouldn't it mean then that you would have the state funding the seminarian training?
If they're at a university in the system, they won't be directly funded as such, but there'll be state resources given to the university depending on its size. So amalgamation could in fact benefit the seminarians, yes, indeed.
This has as its root, as well as a funding crisis that's affecting similar institutions all around the world, including here in Britain, it has as its root also the dispute, doesn't it, between the liberal and conservative wings of the church.
I think that may well be a theme within it, because the Catholic Institute is seen as sort of centre or progressive, I suppose, by its critics. It would be called, not orthodox enough, whereas Notre Dame University really favoured for its orthodoxy, its orthodox position in Catholicism, and that's the marriage that I think is being looked at in terms of feasibility.
Exactly, and this is very interesting in the light of the way the Church is going in Rome at the centre, and with the present Pope and the development of the Church in terms of its very strong conservative core. And I have to say, you're very lucky in Australia to be having this new pilgrim centre. We're all very jealous here, because that was the former home of the Marist Fathers, wasn't
it? That's right, yeah, that's right.
Yes, and it's the most beautiful building, and I think that you will find lots of other English-speaking churches may be trying to catch a nice day.
Ruth Gledhill, religion correspondent for The Times of London, thanks again for being part of the program.
Thank you. Goodbye.
This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. You can download your favourite Sunday night interviews from our website at abc.net.au/Sunday Nights with an S. Thank you for listening.